Good afternoon. You are tuned in to a Juno Afternoon here for Monday, the 28th of December, the year 2015. Jeff Brown, your host today. Today we'll find out about this weekend's Swing in the New Year concert and dance with the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival with Reggie Schapp and John Haywood. We present a profile of the Ernest Greening Cabinet at Malaga Harbor featuring his grandsons, Clark, Quinn, and Brad. Feature writers Almanac and Myrna, music and more today on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Stephen Emmons, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The supporters of four men whose convictions in a murder case were thrown out this month say officials need to take action against ongoing racial bias. Their comments come after the Fairbanks police chief abruptly reversed course in the days following the release of the men held in prison for 18 years. A settlement agreement throughout their convictions, KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
At a press conference, Fairbanks City Police Chief Randall Aragon retracted comments made just days earlier about the Fairbanks 4 settlement. He originally said that the men's release resulted from political pressure, and the agreement vindicated police and prosecutors' handling of the John Hartman murder case.
You know, I could go on and on and on and apologize. You know, words are like bullets. They're, once fired, they're almost impossible to recover. I always say that. But I want you to know this. My heart was there. My heart is with the Native community.
Aragon also reversed an assertion that the 1997 Hartman murder case is closed, saying instead that city police will follow up on new information and alternate suspects brought forward during a Fairbanks 4 post-conviction relief hearing this fall. Aragon attributed his earlier misstatements to not getting to review the settlement document and to being coached by state officials on what to say to the media. Fairbanks 4 supporter Dorothy Shockley thanked Chief Aragon for his apology, but says handling of the case points to an ongoing issue.
As a Native community, you know, that's what we're telling people. You know, there is racism. We are treated differently. And unfortunately, a lot of times it's not in a good way.
Shockley says she'll have to see action, not just words, to believe positive change is happening at the police department. City Mayor John Eberhardt committed to pursuing an independent review of Fairbanks police handling of the case. For National Native News, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
One lasting message from this year's Lakota Nation Invitational is a suicide prevention program. The Bear Project, performed at Rapid City's Rushmore Plaza Civic Center to draw awareness to the youth suicide epidemic on reservations. China Lockett has more from the group.
Seven young suicide survivors lined up in front of a crowd of people for their performance early Friday afternoon. Four of them held the most common tools used in suicide on the reservation: a rope, an alcoholic beverage called juice, a knife, and a gun. 19-year-old performer Brian Sherman consoled each performer and took the weapon out of their hands. The piece represented how a person coming out of their comfort zone to help someone in need can prevent a death. Sherman is a choreographer and has been a performer for the group since 2010.
I know I saved a lot of lives. I mean, I've had friends that came from perfect homes and you would never think they would be, you know, having their own problems. And they reached out to me and I helped them. We do a lot of community outreach. We host dances. We DJ weddings. We do just about anything we're asked.
Dance routines also included animal mascots dancing to popular songs to engage with younger audience members. Tiny DeCorey is the founder of the Bear Project. She says sharing stories that deal with suicide directly are important in combating it.
In one month alone in September, we had 66 attempts. 66 attempts. Not an ideation. An actual attempt. The cutting, overdosing of pills, and the actual rope around their neck and hanging themselves. That's astounding. We're still in our state of emergency. Our kids haven't stopped. We buried two in November. We buried four in August. They haven't stopped. And we haven't stopped either. We're going to continue to be out there. We're going to continue to be out there, and we're going to continue to do the work that we have.
DeCorey says members of the Bear Project share their stories so kids and families can relate and see that they're not alone in their struggles. For National Native News, I'm Trina Lockett in Rapid City, South Dakota.
And I'm Stephen Emmons.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the National Indian Health Board. Open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace ends January 31st. Many Indian health clinics are hosting enrollment events with help available. You may qualify for low-cost plans, zero copays, and deductibles. More info at healthcare.gov/tribal.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Program support is provided by the Sandpiper Cafe, family-owned and operated since 2006. Serving a full breakfast and lunch menu, including espresso, located on Willoughby before the downtown exit and open at 6 a.m. 7 days a week. Gift certificates available for the holidays.
It's 6 minutes after the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon here on listener supported KTUO and KRNN. In the studio with me now are two people from the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival and also the Thunder Mountain Big Band, John Haywood and Mezzy Schapp. Thank you for coming into the station today.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
Yes, thank you.
So, first of all, let's talk about the Thunder Mountain Big Band. How long has it been around, and how many people are in it?
Well, it's there's been a big band for quite a number of years here. And Mel Flood had one back in the 80s, early 90s. And then for a while, Galen Trumbull was running a band through the community schools. And then Ron Moss decided to start a real professional big band and have regular rehearsals. And I'm not sure exactly when that was. I was involved with it, but it's been quite a few years now. And the band consists of 16 people, of course, led by Ron, playing solo trumpet. And there are four trumpet players, four trombones, five saxophones, a rhythm section, piano, bass, and drum, and two vocalists, Vicky Van Fleet and myself. And we have a guest violinist for the New Year's Eve, Steve Tada.
How do you determine who gets to sing? Between you and Vicky, how do you arrange that?
Well, the Vicky was a vocalist when we started. And I was playing sax then. Vicky right now does a lot of the regular jazz standards, and I end up with the Frank Sinatra tunes for the most part.
How are your pieces arranged?
Well, the arrangements are purchased, and they're designed for big bands. So they have parts for each one of these instruments, but we can modify the arrangements and make them our own here, change some things, add some solos in some places and do things like that, so we can feature more of the band.
I've seen you play before. Who do you think is more fun, the band or the audience?
That's a good question. We try to keep up with the audience and having fun. I think we do a pretty good job of having fun, but the audience does as well.
You're playing Thursday night at Centennial Hall.
No, at the Jack.
At the Jack, I'm sorry.
At the Jack, yeah. Swing in the New Year, a benefit for the 2016 Juno Jazz and Classics Festival, is Thursday night, New Year's Eve. Dance lessons start at 8. They're free of charge. And 9 o'clock, the big band will start playing, and they'll be dancing the way, rocking in the new year.
What do you think is the secret to successful dancing? Do you have to wear the right shoes?
Comfortable shoes and just come and have fun. There's no right or wrong way, in my opinion, to dance. It's whatever you feel like you want to do.
How much does it cost?
The reserve seats, to have a reserve seat, is $60. General admission is $50.
And what time did the dance lesson start again?
8 o'clock.
Who's teaching them?
Pat Balick and her husband, Frank.
Sounds like a lot of fun. It's a benefit for the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival.
It is a benefit for the festival, coming up May 6th through May 21st.
How do you determine which pieces are going to be in what order?
Well, we've worked with the dance groups over the years, and they like to have different types of music clustered together so that once they get on the dance floor, they can stay out there. So we get Latin tunes. We do maybe a tango or a samba or a bossa nova, and then maybe a couple of swing tunes and jazz waltzes, you know, ballads, things such as that. So grouping them together works pretty well.
Reggie, tell me some people who are coming up for the Jazz and Classics Festival this year.
Oh, the festival this year, Linda's been working very hard. Our opening night this year is going to be the Papa Chubby Blues Band. We're going to have a dance party with Papa Chubby out at A&B Hall. And the next night on February 6th will be the Blues Cruise on Saturday. Midweek, we have Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn coming up. And then for our festival finale, we have Mavis Staples of the Staple Family Singers. It's really exciting because we were watching the Grammy nominations, and both Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn and Mavis Staples are 2016 Grammy nominees. So that's pretty cool that we are bringing up these bands in the height of their playing. So we're very excited about it.
Are tickets on sale yet?
Tickets will go on sale to our donors on February 1st and to the public on February 21st.
And it's funded by dances like the one on Thursday night.
Yes, that helps raise money for air travel, food, accommodations, everything that it takes, as well as the fees that we pay for the artist. So it's a big production for those 16 days. We'll also have the favorites that people love, the strings at the Shrine, the Blues Cruises, putting on the Ritz out at the university. So there'll be a lot of fun going on for 16 days here in Juneau.
Plus a variety of classical artists, too.
A variety of classical artists. Of course, we have the Vega String Quartet. And this year, for our anniversary year, as always, Linda Rosenthal will also be playing and having a concert night this year. So that's something I'm looking forward to, as well as Paul and Evan Drachman are coming back. Paul Rosenthal and Evan Drachman. So it should be a wonderful lineup.
Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Well, just as part of your tickets for Swing in the New Year, there are complimentary hors d'oeuvres and champagne toast at midnight, as well as we'll be having a no-host bar. So when you get parched, you can still get something to drink before, in between dances.
All right. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
with Linda Mountain Big Band. They'll be performing this Thursday night as part of the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival Swingin' the New Year celebrations. Dance lessons are starting about 8 or 9 o'clock. Tickets are available at jazzandclassics.org.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 28th of December, 2015. It was on this date in 1065 Westminster Abbey was consecrated in London. There had been a monastery there in the late 8th century. And in 1040, King Edward the Confessor ordered construction of a new stone church. By the time it was consecrated, 25 years later, he was too ill to attend. He died a few weeks later, and he was buried in front of the high altar. It's the birthday of the man who said, "Lead us not into temptation, just tell us where it is, we'll find it." Sam Levinson, the humorist, born New York City, 1911. It's the birthday of the novelist Simon Raven, born in London, 1927. He was going to become a professor of literature, but he said, "I very soon concluded that nothing would induce me to read, let alone take notes on, hundreds and hundreds of very, very, very boring books. So he turned to writing fiction instead." Author of a 10-volume series of novels called Alms for Oblivion. First volume came out in 1964. It's the birthday of Stanley Martin Lieber, born in New York City, 1922. Grew up watching Errol Flynn movies and reading boys' adventure stories. Decided to be a writer. But he got a job just out of high school as a gopher for a publishing company that put out comic books. At first, he went to work getting people coffee, sweeping the floors, and running errands. Then he began to proofread, and then he began to write the occasional script. But he was embarrassed working on comic books. So he gave himself a pseudonym by taking his first name, Stanley, and dividing it in half, and calling himself Stan Lee. He was 18 years old when the editor of the publishing house quit, and Stan Lee got the job as head editor and writer. He was embarrassed still about working on comic books. He thought what they lacked was complex characters, and he set out to create characters that he personally could relate to, heroes with feet of clay. He created the Incredible Hulk, the X-Men, Thor, Doctor Strange, and the Amazing Spider-Man, an awkward teenager, Peter Parker, who develops superpowers after he's bitten by a radioactive spider. He was the first superhero to be filled with self-doubt, the first superhero to struggle with the question of whether he wanted to be a superhero at all. The publishing company hated the idea of Spider-Man, but the first issue sold every copy, and he went on to become one of the most popular superheroes ever invented. Here's a poem for today by Billy Collins, Hippos on Holiday. Is not really the title of a movie, but if it were, I would be sure to see it. I love their short legs and big heads, the whole hippo look. Hundreds of them would frolic in the mud of a wide, slow-moving river, and I would eat my popcorn in the dark of a neighborhood theater. When they opened their enormous mouths, lined with big, stubby teeth, I would drink my enormous Coke. I would be both in my seat and in the water, playing with the hippos, which is the way it is with a truly great movie. Only a mean-spirited reviewer would ask, on holiday from what? Hippos on Holiday by Billy Collins from Aimless Love, published by Random House, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for this station comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, located at 105 Savico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Ice Arena is open 7 days a week, offering drop-in, open skating, hockey, and a variety of special events. We are the proud home of the Crimson Bears hockey team, youth, adult, hockey, and figure skating programs. More information at juno.org/parksrec/ice rink or call 586-0410.
It's about 20 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon here on listener-supported KTO and KRNN. Coming up next, segment of the Mudrooms presentation was recorded earlier this month, featuring Phoebe Rohrbacher. Full show is on KTO tonight, or Thursday night at 7 o'clock on KTO News. Here's Phoebe Rohrbacher.
Phoebe Rohrbacher, known as a cigar-chomping, whiskey-drinking, poker-playing, pistol-packing, good-time gal... Phoebe Rohrbacher is 5'7", about 155 pounds, has brown hair and glasses. She will be relocating to Fairbanks in January, our loss, and she will miss most of you. Look for her as the Miss Goldstream Valley. Here's Phoebe.
Okay, I'm going to start out by reading a letter to the editor from December 2007. I did not write this, but anyway. Hit by a car, saved by physical fitness. Monday, December 10th, 2007. I recently celebrated my 90th birthday, but while I was out for a walk on November 17th, I was struck by an automobile on Evergreen Avenue near my home. Sound off on the important issues at. The driver experienced poor vision on the windshield and was distracted, attempting to eliminate the problem, when the vehicle struck me, knocking me off my feet into a guardrail, a heavy steel guardrail. The emergency room at Bartlett Regional Hospital spent 3 hours doing x-rays and multiple checks on my body, but found no broken bones. I have extensive lacerations on my legs, and I am recovering slowly. This accident was as close to death as I ever care to be. Therefore, I point to the urgent need for sidewalks. I believe this miracle is due to my excellent physical condition, and I'm probably the best walking advertisement for JRC/the Alaska Club. Sincerely, Dean Williams, Juno. Yeah, who here remembers Dean Williams? Yeah. So I guess my question you're probably all asking is, what kind of a monster would hit a 90-year-old man with their vehicle? Not only 90-year-old man, a 90-year-old local tennis legend and pioneer, Dean Williams. The answer is, you're looking at her. It was me. I'm a monster. Okay. So I guess my end of the story is it's that I'm guilty. I did it. But I had just gotten my license at a ripe old age of 20 years old. And so I'd been driver for about 6 months, and I was 21 at this point. And I was house-sitting for my friend's parents. I had borrowed their car. I was going to go to North Douglas, and I never made it to North Douglas. It was winter, November. I was driving down Evergreen Avenue, and the windshield was foggy, but it was one of those things where you think, like, oh, it's a little bit foggy, but it'll clear up. Bad idea. The moral of the story is always clean off your windshield. I'm driving at a slow pace, and I realize, you know, it's actually very foggy. It's going to be really difficult for me to continue this journey if I am dangerous. It's going to be dangerous, frankly. There's no sidewalks. I might hit someone. I should probably clean off my windshield. So I lean down, and I'm trying to mess with the defrost buttons. And on your own car, you know exactly where that is. But remember, this is my friend's parents' minivan, so I don't know. I can't find it. I'm trying to press the buttons. I lean down for like 5 extra seconds, and that's when it happens. The unmistakable thud of a human body. On a car, it's terrible. And I'm smiling right now, but it was horrifying. And I slammed on the brakes, and I just looked up to heaven, and I said, "What have I done?" And I jumped out of the car, and I looked around, and then there's nothing. And I was like, "That's a miracle." I was false alarm. I guess I didn't hit anything. And that's when this spry, very physically fit old man popped out from behind the car, and he's like, "I just turned 90 years old. Can you fetch me my cap?" And I was like, "Yes, I can." And his cap had flown over the guardrail. Luckily, I was like, "Oh, thank God it was just his cap and not him." So I ran down to get the hat, and then I brought it back to him. And then I said, "You know, we need to call the police. I think I need to go spend the rest of my life in jail." But I was like, "I don't have a cell phone. Do you have a cell phone? Probably not. You're 90. So anyway, not that 90-year-olds can't have cell phones. But anyway, neither of us had a cell phone, neither the young nor the old. And he's like, "You can come to my house to use the phone." And so I was like, "Do you want a ride?" And he was like, "No, thank you. I'll walk." So he walked himself back to his house. I'll speed this up. But he walked himself back to his house, and I followed close behind, and he was looking behind him, making sure I wasn't going to finish the job. So we get to his house, and he's just so nice. I mean, the whole time, I'm hysterical at this point. This is my life. I almost killed a man. I just wanted to go to North Douglas, and this was not how I expected my night. And we get to his house, and we go in, and he says, Edna, there's someone I'd like you to meet. This is Phoebe. She just hit me with a vehicle." And Edna comes out, sweet as pie. "Oh, what a pleasure to meet you." I mean, it was almost like, I was like, these people are, I want them to be my grandparents. If they're so nice to this person who just ran them over, like, what would they be, how would they be to somebody who they actually know and love? So anyway, Edna starts making me a cup of tea. Like, they're both just like, "You know, this happens." And they give me some tea, they give me some cookies, and then Dean is like, "You know, why don't you just take some deep breaths?" You know, he's like, "You know, this Edna and I, our names are palindromes. DEANEDNA. And I was like, "Oh, I'm so glad." And then he's like, "You know, this is the closest I've ever come to death. And I fought the Japanese. And I was a logger." So what I'm hearing here is that this is a man who survived the Japanese Imperial Army and an unregulated timber industry pre-OSHA. What they couldn't do, I almost did. So anyhow, as Kevin pointed out, it's really hard to repay this kind of kindness. They were there for me in my time of need. And I decided I'll invite him to our family's Christmas party. Just to make up for it, I guess. "I'm sorry I ran you over. Do you want to have some cookies?" I don't know. So anyhow, he came over, and he entered our house. He's looking around. It's decorated. And he's like, "Oh, what lovely Christmas decorations." And as he said it, he just tripped over our ottoman and tumbled onto our floor, probably hurting himself again. So at this point, I was thinking, you know, the kindest thing I can do is to distance myself and let him live out the rest of his days in peace, which he did. He lived another 5 long years, and in some ways, I think I might have given him a new lease on life. So I guess who's the kind one now? No, I'm just kidding. Truly, though, I Dean, if you're listening up there, thank you for the kindness you showed me. And I'm really sorry that I ran you over. So, thank you.
Stevie Roebucker recorded live. It's part of the December Mondays show. The whole show will be on this Thursday at 7 o'clock on KTOO News. You know.
This New Year's Eve, boogie down with KXLL for all that glitters is soul. A disco sparkle party at the Alaskan. We'll be spinning a funky mix from 9 until close with a Soul Train dance contest at midnight. No cover and 21 and over. Peace, love, and sparkle.
In the summer of this year, several Alaskan artists were selected to take part in a pilot artist-in-residence program at the Ernest Greening State Historical Site at Amalega Harbor, about 16 miles from downtown Juneau. As one of the artists, I chose to profile the former Alaskan territorial governor and one of Alaska's first United States senators through the eyes of his grandsons, Clark, Wynne, and Brad. I conducted interviews at the cabin as well as here at KTOO. I also took numerous photos in an attempt to capture the essence of the site. These were combined with archival images from the Alaska State Historical Library, from the Greening family, and other sources. With the help of David Waters, I produced a short audio-video profile, which we present here for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to view the whole production, please go to KTOO's homepage at ktoo.org. On the banner, hover over the program's link. From there, click on the Juneau Afternoon link and navigate your way to the program for today to view the YouTube presentation.
I'm Wynne Greening. I'm Ernest Greening's grandson.
I'm Brad Greening, Ernest Greening's grandson.
I'm Clark Greening, another one of the grandsons.
Well, when I was younger, I really did not know exactly what he was involved in and what he did until the later years. He was a man who was always busy. He was always reading, typing. I did not understand really what business he was in. I knew he was a territorial governor at one time, and he was heavily into politics. As far as a worldwide view, I didn't realize until later, my later years, who he really was.
Well, when I got old enough to really appreciate all the things he was doing, one of them was after he was no longer a territorial governor and we hadn't gotten statehood yet, he was kind of writing a book about statehood. And a lot of that was typed on an underwrite typewriter, and he just peck away at that and try to get this book together. It was done in other venues, but a lot of it was done out at the cabin.
Well, when I was younger, I knew he was somebody very important because, of course, we spent a lot of time at the governor's house. We called it the governor's mansion back then, but we'd spend a lot of time there, and he was always visited by a lot of people. There were obviously important people that came to talk to him at all times of the day and night. Even as a young person, I knew that he was pretty important.
My grandfather and grandmother showed up. They came in 1939. They did a lot of picnicking out here. After World War II, he bought this property here. They constructed the cabin in 53, I think, and then they just enjoyed it from then. And then we started to use it. It'd come out every weekend in the summer. It was just a great place to spend with the family and just be out here, waking up in the morning out here, nobody around. It was really, very, really nice. I just loved it when I was a kid. Still like it. I still come out here and go fishing all the time in Peterson Lake.
They spent a lot of time out here fishing and picnicking, and they often thought that it would be nice to build a cabin out here. And one day, when they were out here, they discovered a person who had an adjoining piece of property that had, their place had burned down. And before they knew it, they had struck a deal to buy that piece of property. And they went ahead and leased the property that this cabin is on under the Homestead Act. And my father then did the same thing with another adjoining piece of property. And when all three of those pieces of property came together, that's the property here that you see today. One of the things I really liked to do, in fact, we all did as kids when we were at Eagle Rock, was we used to take the canoe. There was this old Grumman canoe that had air pockets on either end of it, aluminum, and we'd take it out in the middle of that lake, which is what people know as the Salt Chuck, and we'd essentially sink it in the middle of the lake, and it would sit there right below the surface, and we'd use it as a diving platform. And it was our own little pier that we would dive off of and swim all day on. As long as you stayed in about the top 2 feet of water, you were pretty good. Once you got below that, it was awfully cold.
It had a long and a somewhat rough life. This was way after I was out as a young man. I came back during the legislature, and Terry Gardner, who was another legislator, and I decided we're going to shoot the falls. That's when it's at low tide and there's a lot of water coming out of the lake into the salt water. Unfortunately, we got caught between two rocks, and it bent the canoe something into a kind of a pretzel, and our dad wasn't too happy about that, but fortunately, it was a Grumman canoe. He took it into the Alaska Coastal, and they fixed it, because they can fix anything that's a Grumman. And that canoe managed to have another life. The summers were wonderful. And, of course, you remember the good days. It seemed like it was sunnier in those days. And one of the rituals was, after doing whatever you did during the day, picking berries or doing nature walks, and Ernest knew all the fauna and flora by their Latin names and their real names, and would explain what trees there are here and plants and so forth. And we'd often have a fire down on the beach. But the ritual was, before dinner, we'd go swimming.
Start the fire first.
Yeah, start the fire first. Get it really going, because the water is cold.
We had one special rock that at a certain tide it was a kind of a flat rock that sort of angled into the water, and we'd all go down there and scooch into the water from there and go swimming. And my grandfather would always go, oh, he'd be out there swimming, he'd have a great time. He'd always go, toasty, yeah, toasty, and we'd just be freezing. It was actually something that we enjoyed, even though we didn't want to do it. It was fun to do.
So we went in, believe it or not, with nothing more than tennis shoes, because you know, you needed the tennis shoes, particularly if it's low tide. It was a pretty quick dip, and then we'd have a little fresh water that you could wipe yourself off if you didn't like the salt, although a lot of the fresh water came around from the lake. And so that was our bathing, and then we'd eat at the table and watch the sunset. Eagle Rock played a big role in our father's life. Hunt Greening was the son, surviving son, and he flew Grumman Goose's many planes, World War II pilot.
There was nobody out there at the time. There was a few people. Ackermans had horses and cows and mules, and we used to try to ride those. And it was just a great place to spend the summer, and when the grandparents were there, we would spend almost all summer out there with them. And then when they weren't there in the summer, we would come out with our mom and dad every weekend. The road going out there was just a little narrow little road, and the trees were all grow over the trees, and you'd be going like driving out there in a tunnel, and because the pavement ended at the airport. It was just a great place to grow up. There was so much stuff to do, hiking, fishing, chasing Ackerman's cows, and there was just some hide and seek, exploring the woods, just doing all that. It was just a lot of fun. And a lot of good memories with the family.
I remember standing there shivering in front of those fires in the cabin that we lit, especially just to stay warm, because there wasn't any other heating in the cabin other than an old oil stove, which helped keep the cabin warm. But the large fireplace that was there was also one of our ways that we kept warm. And it sure helped save us when we got back from those swims in the ocean out in front. My grandmother was really involved in the arts over the years. In fact, she's the one that also made us take art lessons when we were kids. She thought it was very important, and I remember visiting some artist studio in downtown Juneau where we took art lessons every day. And in fact, she arranged to have some of our artwork, as bad as it was, placed inside the Nugget, Bell Simpson's Nugget shop, with a price tag on it. And we were there alongside other artists like Sidney Lawrence and everyone else. And she was just as proud of our art as I'm sure she was of some of the other Alaskan artists out there. Our art, of course, never sold. One of the most favorite games we used to play when we were out at Eagle Rock was to play in the skunk cabbage that was out up Peterson Creek. And the skunk cabbage could grow, it used to grow over our heads. We were obviously that tall then. And we'd play for hours in the skunk cabbage and in the fern patches. And then we'd come home when we heard the bell ring. It was time to come home for dinner. But we could play all day out there.
Well, for summers, you know, when we're not going to school, it's a place where we spent, you know, at least a week maybe without going to town. The drill was you'd go to the Menonhall Lake and get the ice because that's the only way you could kind of refrigerate anything. So it was the trip out to the glacier, and that time the glacier had, you know, all kinds of icebergs all over. And so you load up with ice and take it out. That was our refrigeration.
The ice expeditions that we used to have were important because of the fact that we had no refrigeration out there. And, of course, everyone knows that glacier ice lasts for a long time. So the ice box we had, that glacier ice would be in there for weeks and keep all our groceries cold.
Well, Edna Thurber was one that wrote the book. She was a great novelist. And she came out, and they had a little party, and there were a lot of people around, and Edna Thurber was there, and our grandmothers went around spraying DDT, the author was trying to cover her glass of whatever they were drinking from all this DDT that was being sprayed in the air because of the mosquitoes. The author survived and wrote many novels.
We used to do a lot of clam digging out there with our grandparents. We'd go over to where the boat harbor is now, the launch ramp, and right off to the right-hand side was a great clam beach. We used to dig clams there, and my grandfather just loved it, digging clams. And, of course, the boat launch ramp wasn't there then, and there's actually very few people living out there then. We'd bring our friends out with Dennis Egan, who'd come out with us. And Jim Abel, and I don't know who else we brought up, but it was quite a number of different people. And they'd come out and spend the week with us, and we'd just go out and just be kids. You know, we'd just go have a good time. I mean, there was just nobody out there. And as Wynn said, the fern patch was a big one, hide-and-seek in the fern patch. I did a lot of fishing when I was there, a lot of fishing in the off the rocks in front. We used to dip herring. Remember, we used to go dip herring in April when the herring run was
there? When they lay eggs. And Dorothy just loved to eat those eggs right off the rocks.
Yeah.
Herring eggs. I wanted to tell one little short story about Dorothy and Pop, and I was there. And we went to Malaga Harbor, again, that beach that is about halfway between
Scout Camp.
And Pop, we called him Pop, wanted to go on a nature thing, so we were walking along the old railroad that was part of that Malaga mine. And when we came back, after, you know, spending 20 minutes, 25 minutes out on this trail, here's our grandmother, our grandmother, up to her waist in the cold water, just otherwise not much clothing on. We said, well, what happened? She said, a bear came by and sniffed me. I said, oh,
she was sleeping against the rock.
Yeah, and the bear actually did sniff her. And she took off one way, and the bear apparently took off the other way. And sure enough, we looked, and hear the tracks. So that's we called it Dodo's Bear Beach.
Yeah, that's why we called it Bear Beach, because yeah. He was sleeping on the rock. It was a nice, hot, sunny day, and the bear came out and started sniffing her at you. So
Then when we came back, here she's still standing in the water. And we said, oh, no. And then we looked, and there's these tracks.
Yeah.
So we had a bear that routinely would come up and either open the ice box, because we got the ice from the glacier and then put it in there, and that's kind of preserved things that needed preserving. But the bear discovered that, and he was trying to open the ice
cooler.
Box there.
It was, just a
it was a stand-up ice box. And so Bob took a can and put a bunch of rattlers and then opened up the door and went, at the bear, and it, which is not probably the best thing to do, but the bear jumped off the porch, knocked the refrigerator over off the porch, and he ran away. But I thought, that's not very good bear advice to go, surprise a bear.
Lucky you didn't knock over the water barrel. We had a water barrel there that stood up on top, and that was our water. That's how we get our water, and then we collect it off the roof and just regular rain. It was just a great big, like a 55-gallon drum or a little bit oak barrel.
Yeah, it was an oak barrel.
And we just ran a tube down there to the sink, and that was our water. And we had our outhouse was how far away? That was a major walk to that.
Well, the Ark was kind of an interesting story about someone who had wanted to come up here with her family from Seattle, and so built a very large metal boat, which nobody thought would really float and make it all the way to Alaska. There was some controversy about him coming up here because of that, but he eventually managed to get out of Seattle and made it all the way up to Juneau. And that was, his name was, that's when the Satko family came to Juneau. They're an old, well-known family here in Juneau. Unfortunately, during a storm, the boat broke loose and came and actually ended up on the rocks in front of the cabin. And it was never recovered. It just stayed there and slowly deteriorated over time. But it became a great playhouse for us. And as kids, we used to play on it all the time. We'd picnic on it and sit in the wheelhouse while it was still in fairly good shape and pretend to drive the boat around.
And had the motor was in there, and that had the cabin on it, the wheel was in it. I mean, it was just everything, And then, as it slowly decayed, we used it as a sunbathing platform.
And of course, there's very little left there. But if you look very closely now today, you can still see pieces of metal from the original boat that are metal girders and parts of the boat that are still down there on the rocks.
But, the only thing left down there now is the transmission of the engine.
Yeah, there's
nothing else left.
It's all gone.
It's just a great time and a great place.
Eagle Rock is a pretty special place, and the fact that it's been preserved all these years since my grandparents actually built a cabin there in the mid-40s is amazing. And I credit my father with having the foresight to make sure that it was being, maintained by the state over the years and has turned it into a historical park. I think what we'd all like to do at some point is make sure that the public gets more access. I think by doing that, generations of Alaskans to come will get a chance to experience some of the things that we experienced when we grew up there.
That was Wynn, Brad, and Clark Greening talking about their grandfather, Ernest Greening, and the cabin at 17.5 mile near Malaga Harbor. Full audio and video presentations can be seen at the Juneau Afternoon link on the KTOO homepage.
Support for this station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/park/pool. More information at 586-5325.
This is Bird Note. Although the town of Homer is in southern Alaska,
No one would ever think of it as southern on this midwinter day. The temperature is well below freezing, and flurries of snow dance in the blustery wind. This is a place for rugged birders and the even tougher birds they seek. So, let's put on heavy parkas and head on to Homer Spit, on the longest road into ocean waters anywhere in the world. We'll watch in particular for rock sandpipers feeding along the gravelly shore. These small gray shorebirds run or walk this way and that, probing into the gravel and seaweed. Anything that moves is fair game, especially amphipods, the little crustaceans that hop about when exposed. But the birds also recognize clams, snails, and barnacles as tasty food. Gulls, waterfowl, and many other birds forage along the spit, but rock sandpipers are the only shorebirds. Their dense feather coat extends down their legs almost to the ankle, affording some protection from the cold. How do we know exactly which birds winter on Homer Spit? Well, one way is through the annual Christmas bird count sponsored by National Audubon. These counts go on all over the country. You don't have to be an expert to join one. Just bring your binoculars and your curiosity. To find one near you, begin at birdnote.org.
This New Year's Eve, head to the Jack when Juno Jazz and Classics and the Moss Family proudly present Swing in the New Year. Put on your dancing shoes and party the night away to the sounds of the Thunder Mountain Big Band. Enjoy complimentary hors d'oeuvres and a champagne toast at midnight. Tickets and more information at jazzandclassics.org, the Jack, Hearthside Books, and at the door. Get ready to swing in the New Year. A benefit for the 2016 Juno Jazz and Classics Festival.
The New Year's Eve Barn Dance is always a fun and relaxed way to close out the year with friends and neighbors. The Taku Gales provide this year's live music, and Tom Paul will teach and call modern and classic conference square dances. As always, you don't need experience or a partner. Join us New Year's Eve at St. Anne's Parish Hall downtown from 7:30 to 11 for a low-cost, high-fun evening out. Discounts for students and seniors free for AmeriCorps and JVs, sponsored by Juno Folk Dances with help from KTOO. It's the New Year's Eve Barn Dance.
tomorrow at 3 on a Juno afternoon. We'll talk with Amy Skilbert about a social service grant opportunity along with the Juno Community Foundation. We'll also talk with Steve Quinn and Jan Bovitz about youth hockey. Annie Bartholomew and Andrea Kendall will be here to talk about the Sparkle New Year's Eve party at the Alaskan. At Writer's Almanac, Murray Note, using it more tomorrow at 3 o'clock on a Juno afternoon, repeated at 4 here and in. Well, the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with rain and snow likely, about 1 inch of snow expected. Forecast for Tuesday, cloudy skies with chance of rain and snow, high temperatures around 34 degrees. Tuesday night, decrease in clouds with a slight chance of rain and snow, low temperatures around 30 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, increase in clouds with a chance of rain. Wednesday night, Thursday, next few days, looks like rain is in the forecast.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas.